Accession number 7472, rail 3.
Colonel Noble, rail 3.
Trying to find a way around to the right, but this valley, later to be known as Happy Valley, produced no exit route at all. There was no obvious exit route up to the north either, because the mountains appeared to be continuous up there as far as one could go. So, close on the heels of a Gazelle force, who had to withdraw and hold the fort, so to speak, in front, came the 11th Brigade. And with the Brigadier seeing this situation and so on, saying, right, we must get up on these hills and see if we can bounce them and get through. And so the leading battalion, being my old regiment, the Camerons, they were sent up the nearest hill, which was not the highest in that area, to the north side of the road, and which also overlooked the gorge and the road block. This ridge was, I suppose, 300 feet or so lower than the main ridge beyond it, on which the Italian infantry manned. So that the Italians up there could see what was going on this ridge. So it wasn't a particularly healthy place. But two companies got up there fairly quickly, and they had a pretty unpleasant time, as you can imagine. But they stuck it out, and eventually the whole battalion got up there. This place eventually became known and well known as Cameron Ridge. And it was from here that the major attacks on the Italian positions were launched. Right. So we have now one battalion, shortly to be followed by another battalion of 11th Brigade, up on Cameron Ridge, facing the Italians on the higher ridges behind them. And in the hopes of taking these ridges quickly before the Italians could really get settled in, attacks were launched very shortly afterwards from Cameron Ridge onto these Italian positions, which were known as Sanchil, S-A-N-C-H-I-L, which is the highest peak, which overlooked the gorge and the road block. And to the north of it, another feature, which eventually was called Briggs Peak. In other words, the Brigadier was reputed to have said that, take that peak, as a result of which it was called Briggs Peak, and was always referred to as such. Well, Cameron's launched these attacks very early on, and as I explained, the problems that the gunners could see you to within the last 100 feet or so and keep the Italians off the skyline, they couldn't do it the last bit. But in these first two attacks on Briggs Peak, and I think I'm right in saying on Sanchil as well, the Camerons managed to get there in both cases and to get down behind the ridges where the Italians were. But unfortunately, in doing so, they suffered very heavy casualties, mainly from these little red grenades, and those that eventually got there were too thin on the ground to remain. And some managed to get back in due course. Others were taken prisoner, including one young officer who led his platoon up there and was eventually wounded and taken prisoner, by name Peter Cochran, one of our first reinforcement officers to come out from England to join us in Egypt. He had only just left Oxford, and in the city, prior to the Sidi Barani battle, he'd already achieved an MC for his performance at Keren. He received the DSO as well as being taken prisoner. A somewhat unique occasion, should we say, achievement rather, for a second lieutenant. History relates that he was recovered when Asmara was taken, where he was found in hospital, and he's alive and kicking still in Edinburgh. However, that's a little bit of sideline, but we're all rather proud of that. Well, varied attacks took place, again launched from, in the main, from Cameron Ridge, with no more success than the original ones. A second battalion came up from 11th Brigade on to Cameron Ridge, so there were two battalions up there. And further north from those two battalions on Cameron Ridge came up the battalions of the 5th Infantry Brigade, who were manning other positions also up right up in the mountains. So the division had two brigades up in the mountains. And divisional headquarters was, I suppose, quite a distance away from the actual foot of the mountain. It wasn't a very healthy place to sit, just under the foot of the mountain, but in a place where we could see fairly clearly what was going on up there. Meantime, the 5th Indian Division were, should we say, resting behind while the administrative resources were being built up, and eventually it was quite clear that 4th Indian Division were not going to be able to break through this mountain barrier. It was not possible either to break through the gorge. Well, I've talked about the northern, shall we say, side or flank of the gorge, the positions up there in the 4th Indian. Now, what was happening on the southern side? On the southern side, on the roadblock side of the gorge, there was another important position, important to the Italians and, of course, eventually to us, which was an old-fashioned fort. Dolgorodok was its name, and here again, it was from this position it could see all our preparations for any attacks. It was a very important position, and this, of course, also covered any operations in the Happy Valley area. So it seemed in the end, I would imagine, that the divisional commander told the General Platt, who was the, should we say, the equivalent of the corps commander, managing the campaign, that there was really not much future in just bashing ourselves and receiving casualties and getting nowhere. So as soon as administration made it possible, 5th Division came up and took over, shall we say, the opportunities on the right-hand side of the road, in other words, facing Dolgorodok. Meantime, they had also pushed some of their battalions through Cameron Ridge and attacking Briggs Peak and Sancho, and had suffered the same fate as others who had done it before. And it was clear, in the end that a concerted attack by the two divisions, the 4th on the north-hand side of the road and the 5th on the south-hand side of the road, was going to be the only way we're likely to get through. So I think it was on the 19th of March. We arrived in front of Caron around about, I think, the early days of February. And the major attack, I think, came about the 19th of March. And there were two divisional attacks, one on either side of the road. Well, the attacks on the left-hand side, the 4th Indian Division side, did not get through. In fact, I don't think it really did very much better, other than, of course, hold considerable Italian forces in that area. But success came on the 5th Indian Division side, whereby one brigade has stormed the Dorogolodok fort and took over that. That was the beginning, I think, really, of the end at Caron. The gunners, of course, of both divisions were in a position that whatever attack was going in, both divisional artilleries, full force of both, could be directed on single individual targets, which of course was pretty shattering for those at the receiving end. A word or two about the gunners. The Italian gunners were probably the best part of their army, certainly as shown in Eritrea. They had a lot of little small mountain batteries which they moved about all over the place and were handled extremely well and effectively by their OPs and so on. Our gunners, on the whole, had to, because of the countryside, sit down in the valleys, and of course every time a gun went off, the Italian OP spotted it and replied counter-battery-wise. The Italians seemed to have an almost endless supply of ammunition, and in many cases were reasonably quiet days. The only thing that happened was a lot of exchange of gunfire. Well, I talked earlier about colonial regiments. I think I'm right in saying there were only these battalions that were whisked up from Addis Ababa at short notice to Caron, who were really regular Italian troops. The colonial battalions, of course, were in a way somewhat the same idea, perhaps, as an Indian battalion, although, of course, different caliber altogether. They were manned, controlled, led by Italian officers, but the soldiers were the local Ascaris from Eritrea and so on. And although many of them fought extremely well, their morale was nothing like, of course, the same as the Indian battalions. They all carried sashes as part of their uniform, and from which varying colours and patterns and so on, you could tell to which regiment they belong when they were in the prisoner of war cage.
Did they wear those in combat?
Yes. Yes, they did.
Did that prove any disadvantage to the Italians?
I don't think so, no. It was another, shall we say, like wearing a kilt. It meant something to you. It meant something to them. I talked about trying to find ways round. Gazelle found no way around to the south. They did explore somewhere even further around to the south, but I won't go into that. Again, they came up against a terrific wall of rock, mountainous, that no vehicle would ever got by. But we also looked in the division towards what went on in the north side in the distance, and sent out to join us out there and put under the divisional command was one of the first commandos, a local commander, a Middle East commander, which had been formed in Palestine, as it then was, of mixture Arabs and some Jews, I think, were in it as well. And they were trained by a World War I officer of the Greys, who ran an extremely good show. I'm trying to remember his name. He came from a Norfolk family. And they had been sent up round the north flank to see what could be done and to pose some sort of threat to get the Italians to face up to them. Well, I was able to pay a visit to them in a rather quieter period from divisional headquarters. And two of us, the general's ADC and a sapper officer, three of us went up here to this wild place in the middle of nowhere. Most one had to go on one's feet. We went a certain way in a vehicle. And we found this commando tucked away in the mountains sharing a water hole with a pack of baboons. Well, this is an intriguing, shall we say, setup, in that the baboons came to water regularly every day and evening at certain times, whereupon the commando disappeared out of sight and then returned to the water hole after the baboons had left. The commando were up here, I suppose, for the best part of a month. They sent patrols forward and the like, and we went forward with one of their patrols one morning while we were up there, again along a crest into the sort of area of Kerun round the back. And it was intriguing from this, you were literally behind the Italian lines, to look down and see several hundred feet below you Italian troops moving about. Of course, you had no idea that you were sitting on the ridge above. And so they did a good job, in as much as I don't think they had much fighting to do, but they certainly kept quite a lot of Italian troops busy up there. Well, I talked about the first day of the battle on the 19th of March, and this was almost a calamitous day in its way, and particularly at divisional headquarters. I haven't said much about the RAF. I must say the aircraft they had were completely outdated. We had some remarkable machines, biplanes called Hardys. We had some Wellesleys to drop bombs. We had a Vincent, which I think was lucky to keep in the air at 25 miles an hour, but carried a terrific load of bombs. And the Italian CR-42 fighters, when they did come out, were more than a match for these antiquated aircraft, until around about the Battle of Kerun, I think a squadron of Hurricanes was sent down from Egypt to operate with this. But the Hardys were almost death traps to any pilot, and there were some extremely gallant ones who we met and who were shot down simply because they were quite unable to cope with the speed and agility of their CR-42s, the Italians. But on that very first day, the calamity happened in that In error, one of the our own RAF planes dropped a bomb on divisional headquarters, advanced divisional headquarters, which it mistook for an Italian headquarters. In other words, the pilot had lost his way, and he thought he was behind the Italian lines. In point of fact, he wasn't. He hadn't even got up to them. Well, this had a very unfortunate effect because it killed, I think, two or three people, and it seriously wounded the G2, Major Pickin. One or two others. He had to be evacuated, and I, as G3, had to take over as G2 for the rest of the battle.
Were you there when it was bombed?
I was. And the intriguing part was that in those days you used to have what was called a battle board in the ops side, in the back of a vehicle, where all the messages were tied up and so on. And the copies of the messages, so anybody coming along could read and see what had happened. One of these messages had my signature on it, and a piece of this exploded bomb had gone straight through my signature, but not unfortunately through me.
How many bombs were dropped?
I think only one. As far as I remember, I won't put it more than that.
Where did it land in relation to the headquarters?
I would say not right in the middle, but on the outskirts. But I mean, the battle headquarters covered a very small area, and was tucked away. So, but it caused a certain amount of alarm and despondency, as you can imagine. However, that put me in a rather more position, a difficult position for the rest of the battle. But I learned a great deal as a result. So, on went the battle, and eventually there was again almost reached a matter of stalemate. We hadn't made a great deal of progress, if at all, on the north side. The 4th Div and the 5th Div were getting bogged down in the Donegal-Gallagher area, and there was talk, considerable talk, as to whether we should make an attack in another different way. And then it came to light that another, should we say, fact I haven't mentioned is the railway line. Now, there's a railway, an Italian railway, that connected up Gaudat with Keren, Asmara, and Massara. It was of a unique gauge, almost unknown in any other part of the world. And so it was very important to collect, or rather, should we say, capture both locomotives and carriages and what like, if we were going to be able to make use of it. And, of course, it ran through this gorge. And at the edge of Cameron Ridge, where the railway ran underneath it, there was a tunnel. And what the Italians had done was to block this tunnel by disrailed coaches and the like at their end, so that we couldn't get anything further through. And in the end, it was approved, the plan should be that one of the brigades of five Indian Division, the 4th Indian Division was now so weak on the ground we couldn't have taken it on, would attack down the line of the railway through the gorge on the left-hand side, with the on the right-hand side was the roadblock. On the left-hand side of the railway, and they'd go down, whistle down the railway, and break through into the Keren plain.
By day or night?
Well, by night, of course. Or actually, it was early morning. And so, over two or three days, very quietly and gradually, the sappers at our end of the tunnel started to remove the blockages and so on and so forth. so that not necessarily the railway could operate, but at that stage, but so the troops could deploy and get through the tunnel. And so eventually, I think it was round about the 25th or 26th of March, you were funny enough, just about now, came this early morning attack through this tunnel. I would like to attribute it, this idea, to one who achieved great heights, latterly Field Marshal Sir Geoffrey Baker, who in those days was the Brigade Major of Royal Artillery in the 4th Inland Division, a very old friend of mine. I believe it was his suggestion that was of breaking out through the tunnel, which was carried out. But it was the brigade that was then commanded by Brigadier Pete Rees, who I mentioned earlier at Celebrani, had been the G1, GSO1 of the division then. He had been promoted and given this brigade in the 5th Indian Division. And it went like a dream. They went off at the rate of knots, straight down the railway. The Italians were surprised, and they got round behind it. And that was the real beginning of the end. And then white flags started to come up on the mountains, and they gave up on both sides of the of the gorge on Sanchel and Briggs Peak and the Dollar Gorlock area and the like. And eventually they dispersed. Gazelle Force had come to an end. They set up a new force, which mainly from 5 Indian Division, who chased them down the Italians, retreating Italians down the road towards Esmara. But that, the 4th Indian Division, didn't come down any further than actually Caen. And we set up divisional headquarters in the Municipio, which is the sole municipal buildings in Caen, for the time, until again we had a pier jump and we were whistled back to Egypt once more, same way, back to Port Sudan, up the same Reina Pacifica to Suez, and back to the desert to meet Rommel. Then one or two other things I would like to add. Life on Cameron Ridge was not much fun, as I've suggested. Again, in due course, some mules appeared. I think they were Cypriot mules, and took the rations and ammunition and everything up and brought the casualties down. But it was an extremely unpleasant spot. I was able myself to go up there one day from divisional headquarters on a quieter day and actually see what their life was like up there, and go up to one of the gunner OPs and see what they saw, and also watch out for the Italian OPs who were looking at us. But obviously when you're facing each other for a fortnight or more, you can't be fighting flat out all the time. But it was impossible to bury people up there. The smell of death and all the rest of it was very much with one. And so reliefs were organized, and a battalion, for instance, my own battalion, came out. I think they came out for 48 hours. And they were taken fairly well out of the range of the Italian guns, where they had a jolly good sleep and a jolly good wash, and as far as water was concerned, and as much beer as could be available, which was the only, that and cigarettes was the only sort of extra that could be provided under those conditions. And, of course, clean clothing and the like. Really, considering everything, morale was remarkably high.
Was it ever suspect?
Hmm?
Was it ever suspect?
I think there were moments.